Sometime in the middle of last week, I realized that I was coming here. I thought I'd better find out what I said I was going to talk about, so I went and looked on the web and found my title. Then I realized, in fact, I hadn't ever given a title, and so this was the first I knew this was what I was supposed to speak about. I'd not only forgotten to give a title, I'd forgotten to book a hotel. I did at least have a flight, so it wasn't too bad. So I was left trying to figure out what the organizers wanted when they asked me to talk about feedback in numerical simulations. And this could be a talk about all the difficulties in putting real physics into numerical simulations and how the simulations never actually do what you want. Or it could be about what happens if you put a feedback in a numerical simulation, see what you can predict about the real world. And I decided to do a bit of both. So we've heard quite a lot about this. Feedback, of course, means different things to different people. Here are three different kinds of feedback which are important for the interaction of galaxies with intergalactic medium. There's radiative feedback, which may be important in UV or X-rays. And those could come from young stars, they come from AGN, maybe from an early population of POP3 stars. We've heard they could dissociate maybe H2 in the very early structures, affect the cooling of the first objects. They presumably, this can heat and reionize the IGM. Maybe it can suppress the formation of dwarf galaxies, something I'll come back to later. And of course, there's mechanical input in the form of energy from winds. We think of this usually as flows driven by supernovae or stellar winds or AGN. What does this do? Well, I think this probably regulates star formation in some way in galaxies. May drive a galactic fountain, or in extreme cases, drive material completely out of a galaxy in a wind. This then will interact with the surrounding medium in some way. And maybe such energy input from the AGN is what's responsible for suppressing cooling flows in present-day galaxy clusters. Something I'm going to come back to in this talk later. And of course, associated with this, there's actually material transport from one part of the system to the other, which is important. We think this is how the metals get from one part of a galaxy to another, or from the galaxy into the intergalactic medium. And radio galaxies, of course, also put relativistic plasma out into the intergalactic medium. And this is often forgotten about, but the total input of energy or pressure into the intergalactic medium from radio galaxies, it can easily equal the thermal input from all other sources. And so it's unclear that we should be neglecting relativistic plasma and thinking about the equilibrium of the IGM. So this will enrich the IGM, create bubbles. Maybe these bubbles would show up as gaps in the Lyman alpha forest. We haven't seen very many convincing examples of this yet. It would be nice to find some. Feedback can occur at different times. Before reionization, as I said, maybe X-rays or UV in the between 11 and 13 eV could percolate the IGM, destroy H2, reduce the cooling, and perhaps truncate the early formation of objects. At the reionization epoch, then UV from the first galaxies in AGN makes H2 regions. We've heard a lot about this, ionizing and heating the IGM. And the heating from the UV or possibly from early X-ray brings the H1 out of equilibrium with the microwave backgrounds, allows us perhaps to observe the epoch directly, as we heard from Avi and Benedetta yesterday, through 21 centimeter emission. Then at galaxy formation, we believe feedback is important. As I said, we think maybe the hydrodynamic effects control the efficiency of star formation. They appear to do this today in our own galaxy. The winds enrich the IGM, and the AGN ionize at the same time, apparently, helium-2. And in the low redshift universe, we see input from radio sources in cluster atmospheres, and I'm going to argue this may be important for suppressing star formation not only in the centers of clusters, but in most massive galaxies. So we spent a bit of time on numerical issues. This could easily occupy a large amount of time, and there are lots of technical issues. Not terribly exciting, but unfortunately one needs to get them right if you want to believe the results. We already heard from Nick about the problems with radiative transfer. This is what I'm talking about here. So the radiative transfer is perhaps the hardest of the problems dealing with the reionization epoch. So There are problems to do with the rate of transfer technique, what approximations to use, whether they're good enough, in particular whether they're good enough for each particular situation in which we want to use them, whether we treated the transfer correctly enough as a function of frequency to be able to deal with ionization issues. And of course there's the whole problem of where one should put the sources. So you would like the source distribution to be consistent with the distribution of material ionizing, which is not trivial. They're obviously correlated in some way. Then, just because you're forming stars, you don't know how much of the ionizing photons get out of the immediate environment of the star formation into the broader intergalactic medium. And in particular, you don't know whether they escape in an isotropic way or in a beamed way, in an ionization cone, for example. And so this will affect things like the effective spectrum. And of course the dynamics, which has not treated most of the things that have been done so far. The IGM presumably reacts in some way to the overpressure caused by the ionization. This hasn't been treated properly in most of the simulations so far. And so therefore you would like to integrate consistently the ionization and the motions of the gas as a result of this overpressure. There are lots of numerical issues here if you want to solve both these problems together, which people are just starting to grapple with. And then finally there's the issue of how big a region do you need to simulate to get the statistics right for comparing with what we see at redshifts where we can observe something like redshift 6 or so. And I would argue you'd need to simulate regions which are many tens, possibly hundreds of megaparsecs across, which are much larger than has been done so far. So this plot that Benedetta showed us yesterday just shows the difference in reionization between for the same model of the source population and the radio transfer for a typical region of the universe, for a region where a cluster is going to form. This is 30 megaparsecs across co-moving. This is 15 megaparsecs across. And regions like this are roughly 50 megaparsecs across in the universe. And you can see in the higher density region, the reionization starts earlier. This is a reionized H2 region and finishes later. And so you want to know about the statistics in detail, you would need your simulation to contain the full spectrum of possible environments. On small scales, if you want to do the feedback within galaxies, there are lots of issues here too. And this comes, and this is basically the star formation problem in our own galaxy, but now transformed to forming galaxies. It's the structure of the ISM. So we know it's a multiphase structure. And the multiphase structure is related in some way to the star formation activity and the efficiency of star formation. And it's a complex system, which we can't model even well on the scale of a single star-forming region, let alone on the scale of a galaxy. So there are issues about the correct phenomenological way to deal with this. The stuff that goes out, this is a simulation that Volker Springle did with Lars Hernquist. They've injected energy into particles surrounding the star-forming region. You can see arrows going out. It's interacting with stuff which is falling in. Actually can't see the stuff falling in, so some stuff falling in up here, getting a complex interaction. So there are issues whether you've got this part right, actually in the ISM itself, and also whether the mixing between the stuff that's coming in and the stuff that's going out, both things are happening at the same time, is being treated correctly. There are issues about what's energizing the ISM. So we have prompt supernovae and delayed supernovae, stellar winds continuously. The AGN may well be important in high redshift galaxies. And an important issue is how much of the material from the ISM is actually blown out along with the supernova ejector. We have evidence that this is an important process in real galaxies. It's very difficult to simulate, at least to believe you've done it correctly in other ways than an empirical way. Then there are the issues of mixing, how the heavy elements get into different phases. And this is very important because a lot of what happens depends on how the gas cools as it falls in. And how rapidly it cools depends critically on its heavy element content. So in practice, when you try to model these systems, you find that what happens can depend quite heavily on exactly how the heavy elements that you assume are produced here are mixed into the various components of the gas. Because once you mix the heavy elements in, the cooling suddenly becomes much more effective. And so you get a kind of heavy element mediated cooling instability, where the things that cool off are the regions that happen to have the highest heavy element abundance, perhaps just because of numerical issues rather than any physical ones. On larger scales, this is again a different paper by Springle and Hernquist. This is supposed to be at redshift 6. There are star-forming things at the center here. They've put in winds, and they've blown these bubbles, which have a complex structure because of the structure of the medium they're blowing into. And so the question is, of how much of this can you believe? These are temperature maps shown here. So all the interior of these regions is hot. This is the undisturbed IGM outside. So whether this is correct or not, of course, depends on whether the structure that you're blowing into is correct, because you can see that's why these are so irregular, is because you're blowing into something which had pre-existing structure. It depends on whether you can treat properly what happens on the boundary between the different phases. And this may be very important for what we see, because in this interior region, the gas is hot, and there's lots of heavy elements. There's no neutral hydrogen. You would not see this in lime alpha forest. The metals you'd see in the lime alpha forest are presumably due to mixing between this stuff and the stuff around it. And so if you wanted to predict the heavy element contamination correctly, you'd need to understand this mixing, which is, I think, a very difficult problem in practice. Some of the material, of course, falls inside the bubble, then it gets evaporated, or it might even form stars. This will depend on what happens. And then if we replace these with AGN, then you have to ask questions, what happens about the relativistic plasma? Maybe there's additional particle acceleration if these winds are strong enough on the shocks. This could be a significant additional source of cosmic rays. And then, of course, there could be plasma coming from an AGN or radio source at the center, which overall could affect the dynamics. And again, if you want to do statistics, you'll need a large simulation to get a big enough to get all possible environments. Now, I was preparing it, I found this old slide, which I used for a talk at Martin Rees's 60th birthday party a few years ago, which summarized at the time why I thought that radio sources were a critical part of this whole puzzle. And I assigned it as possible homework for Martin, because it seemed to have elements of all the things that he worked on. So there are several things you can see. So we know for a very long time, there's apparently a cooling flow problem in clusters of galaxies, that you see radiation, you see dense gas at the center, it's radiating at a rate which is, when you compare it with this thermal energy constant, suggests it should cool off in a few giga years, and yet you don't see it appear to cool off, and you don't see any star formation or cold gas that could have resulted from this cooling. So what's happening? So there are several things you can find. If you look at the galaxies, clusters where this problem appears to be acute, you see a serious problem, then you almost always find a very bright galaxy at the center, CD galaxy. In fact, the most luminous galaxies known. So these very luminous spheroids are often associated, almost always associated, with strong cooling flows. In addition, you find these objects almost always contain a radio source, whereas galaxies of almost comparable luminosity, which are away from centers of clusters, the abundance of radio sources is much lower. So for some reason, if you're in a cluster, this was a plot from Jack Burns, but you can't read either of the axes, so you can see there's just a correlation between the points. What it shows you is that in regions where the cooling rate is high, you typically find a much higher radio power. And Jack noticed this, and as you can see, a long time ago now. And so luminous radio sources are overabundant, almost ubiquitous, in regions where this problem occurs. Now recently, with better imaging telescopes and the X-rays, we've seen strong correlations between the morphology of the radio source and the morphology of the thermal gas. Here's M84 from a paper by Foreman et al. So that tells us that the radio source is interacting with the thermal gas in the center in some way. So you can observe that the AGN are affecting the cooling gas. So that tells us, you know, we've got almost all the parts of the puzzle to say this must have something to do with it. Radio, wherever there's this problem, there is a radio source. You can see the radio source doing something to the gas. Maybe this is the reason it's not making stars anymore. And the final point, which I think is actually not related to this, although I had on this transparency at the time, I changed my mind about this, is that we see black hole masses correlate strongly with the properties of the spheroidal galaxies in which they're embedded. So this is a plot from Tremaine et al. The mass of the black hole against the velocity dispersion of the stellar bulge in which they find a very good correlation, which tells us for some reason the assembly of the black hole and the formation of spheroid stars are tightly linked to each other. So there is some link between the black hole mass and the stars. So I think this is another kind of feedback, which I'm going to argue I think is critical for massive galaxy formation. There are numerical issues in treating this. When I was preparing this, the only plot I could find was this one from Marcus Bruggen and collaborators of a bubble being injected into an atmosphere, gravitationally confined atmosphere. You can see lots of instabilities as the thing rises. If we want to simulate this process, we need to know what the object is, so what is injecting the relativistic plasma, what the nature of the jet is, what its duty cycle is, its activity, and so on. And we need also to understand how, as the thing interacts with its surroundings, how that affects the fueling. There's an essence of the feedback there. We need to understand how the bubble interacts with the cluster medium, what happens to the hot spot. Presumably we'll get reacceleration of particles there, which may, again, change the pressure. Then on the interfaces, we get lots of structure from Rayleigh-Taylor and other instabilities. And then there are issues of how this relativistic plasma is going to mix with the surrounding thermal plasma. And then there are issues also in whether we can deal with the thermodynamics of the thermal plasma. There's been a lot of talk about such bubbles expanding and sending sound waves out into the intracluster medium, which is supposed to dissipate the energy, heating it. The exact way in which this dissipated is almost certainly not treated in the simulations the same way as it happens in the real world, and we don't really know if we're doing this correctly. So we need to know the structure of the ISM in the inner regions where its cooling time is relatively short, then to understand how the dynamical heating is a dissipation of dynamical heating is occurring. And then we have to worry about what's happening with the relativistic particles and how they're interacting with the thermal gas. Of course, this whole thing is probably related in some way to the cluster-wide dynamics. So there are lots of numerical issues here. How do we deal with this? Well, we deal with this by taking simplified representations of these physical processes and just trying to understand how they interact with each other. So, for example, for reionization and radiative feedback, Nick Nedin did some calculations two or three years ago, maybe a bit longer now, which suggested you could parameterize the reheating produced by reionization simply by an effective filtering mass which suppressed the ability of gas to settle into small halos, which were effectively below an effective Jeans mass. So it's just the fraction of baryonic material in an object as a function of its mass and its redshift is the cosmic baryon fraction times a function which is strongly decreasing with m for m less than a filter mass and is 1 for things bigger than that. There's a simple parameterization of the physics which leads gas to fail to sink into small objects because of the heating. Supernova feedback, we think it reheats the ISM. In local galaxies, particularly dwarf galaxies, it appears that substantial amounts of material are being driven out of the galaxy. So the amount of mass being driven out of the galaxy is proportional to the amount of stars formed with some efficiency. And this number appears to be close to 1 from local observations. Crystal will probably talk about this later in the week, and maybe Tim Heckman also. There's also presumably input directly into hot gas surrounding the star-forming regions through the chimneys and the hot phase of the interstellar medium. And the energy input is some fraction of the total input from the supernovae. So this is just the amount of stars you make. The amount of energy for a given mass in stars is some, the dimensional grounds is some velocity squared times this. This is to get an energy. For a standard IMF, this velocity would be about 700 kilometers a second. And some fraction of that may go to heat the hot gas surrounding the galaxy by going out through gaps in the interstellar medium. And this may result in material being ejected from the galaxy completely, not only from the cold medium, but from the whole galactic halo. And so you can imagine the amount that's ejected is the amount of energy you put in the halo, mind the amount of energy you need to take this mass out of the disk and put it in the halo. So this amount of energy would be left over, which in principle would take mass out of the halo altogether and would result in ejecting some mass. So some, again, you could put another efficiency factor in here. There's just scaling arguments of how things might scale with the properties of a system. If we want to put in AGN, I would argue there are two modes where we see things happening. There's the, if you like, the quasar mode, where in local galaxies with quasar-like activity, we see star formation associated with the Aegean activity in almost all cases. And this may be the reason why we get such a tight relation between the mass of stars and the mass of the black hole. So you could argue there's a quasar mode where accretion onto the black hole and building up of stars occurs together, maybe as a result of mergers or whatever. This builds up black hole masses and establishes the Megorian relation. And the feedback there is presumably in some way proportional to the amount of stars you form, so this would perhaps already be included in the efficiency parameters I put up here. But we need a second mode which would correspond to the radio galaxies. Because when you see the radio galaxies, energy is apparently being put into the surrounding medium and no stars are forming. And this is an important difference. So then you could imagine a radio mode where the amount of mass that's actually able to cool off from the hot phase in a cooling flow is reduced from what it would be in the absence of the radio source by some term which will increase with the mass of the black hole, and it turns out you need it to increase with the temperature of the system which you're embedded to get a reasonable behavior. But we don't know exactly what these exponents should be. You can make a simple model based on Bondi-Hoyle accretion or whatever and guess at these exponents, and we wouldn't know what this coefficient would be. But this then, the energy input from the black hole will reduce the amount of mass that's able to cool. So we take all these kinds of feedback and ask, what's this going to do? How can we study the influence of these processes on the observed galaxy population? So first, we will need techniques to include these properties in a large-scale simulation where we can actually simulate the formation of the galaxy population. Techniques of this kind have been developed over the last decade or so, and the stuff I'm going to show you is based on techniques in... this is supposed to be Kaufman and Henop 2000, I forgot the date, Springer et al. And most of the work on the detailed modeling I'm going to show you has been done by my great student Darren Croton, and will be coming out soon. And of course we need simulations which have high enough resolution to follow the assembly of things that are going to represent small galaxies. But simultaneously, they have to have a large enough volume to be able to represent the full range of environments. So you need to be able to represent bright galaxies, galaxy clusters, quasar hosts, the host of the Sloan quasars if you're ambitious. So you want to have this condition and this condition at the same time, then clearly you'll need simulations with a very large number of particles to represent small things in a large volume.
Or you have to cover some regions.
Sorry?
Some regions.
Well, you want the full statistics. Basically, you need all the small objects in your larger region, or at least a representative sample of them.
Well, we don't take observers, we don't observe the whole region. Every galaxy.
Well, no, I'd say by observing, for example, the Sloan sub, we learned a lot, which we didn't know from much smaller samples, so surveying the whole local volume did make a big difference. Luckily, if you want to do large numbers, you just have to wait, because computers and programmers get better. So this shows you the number of particles in high-resolution cosmological simulations function of epoch from Peebles' first simulation in 1970 to today. And the number doubles every 16.5 months. Extrapolate this, you get to 10 to the 10 in 2008. Falco's been working hard, so actually we got there already. So I'm going to show you results from a simulation with just over 10 to the 10 particles. The region simulated is half a gigaparsec on a side, with a spatial resolution everywhere of 5 kiloparsecs. So the dynamical range is only 10 to the 5, which is much less than Tom was telling us about earlier on, but we have this resolution everywhere in the volume, not just in one region where something interesting is happening. Standard cosmology. This took quite a lot of time on a... this supercomputer with 512 nodes. It took 28 machine days going at a measured speed, mean speed of 0.2 teraflops. Produced a lot of data because we want to follow the formation of every object in this region. Since I'm short of time, I won't tell you the story behind that. The only point about this one is you could see who did the work and who had the fun. Even though I don't have much time, I'm still going to show you Falco's movie here. This was our old largest simulation with 10 to the 9 particles. This is what a cluster looked like in it. It only had a few hundred particles. This is the new simulation 10 times as many particles, and we've cheated to be able to plot such a large region here by, well, I'll tell you later. We're just going to zoom in. There's a cluster at the center here. Now, since there are 25 resolution lamps across here and only 1,000 on my computer screen, we have to zoom by a factor of 100 in order so you can see all the structure. So we'll just keep zooming down. This is color-coded, so intensity is density, and color is velocity dispersion. So blue regions are cold, and red and yellow regions are hot. So you can see this is actually quite a massive cluster. I'll show you what's inside it a bit later. Sorry? It's just under 10 to the 9. It's 7 times 10 to the 8, or 8 times 10 to the 8. So this object has a few million particles in it inside the virial radius. Okay, we're getting down there. The virial radius of this thing is about here. Okay, change the color scale about now, I think, or somewhere about now. So you can see the substructure better. Okay, so there we are. A lot of structure. We have this much resolution throughout the volume. Of course, you can look back in time. You've got redshift 1.4, 5.7. This is the time, 18 was the time when the first objects that we could detect were collapsing. So you can see this is mostly near theory. So the advantage of this now is we can follow the galaxy formation in this region. So here's a plot of the mass on this scale. I can show you a plot of the light from all the galaxies. There are several million in this region. And this is now the light smooth, color-coded. You can see red light in the clusters, blue light outside. You look at particular objects. Here's what might be a Sloan quasar. The most extreme objects of redshift 6.2. So this is just the dark matter. There's a massive object here. You see this filamentary structure that Lem was talking about. These are the galaxies. This is the most extreme one. So this particular halo had a mass of nearly 10 to the 13 solar masses. And the stellar mass of this object is about 10 to the 11. And its current star formation rate at this time is 235 solar masses per year. So you can ask, where did that come from and where did it go? And you can see there actually are many other objects, which are not that much smaller. I mean, they're smaller by factors of 10 or so. And these could be the filaments that Lem was talking about. This is where it ended up, at redshift 0. It ended up in a cluster which is one of the most massive clusters in the volume, more than 10 to the 15 solar masses. And the object is, in fact, the CD galaxy of this cluster. In fact, all the massive quasars, all the most massive objects at redshift 6, ended up in CD galaxies at the end. And this particular object was first found, had a halo mass of a couple times 10 to the 10 already at redshift 17. It already had substantial numbers of stars there. If you have this, you can measure the masses of halos with a lot of precision. Let me go through this fairly quickly. This is an empirical fitting formula from fits to previous simulations. You see, nothing was adjusted. You can see we understand how to predict the dark matter masses of objects very well. As Nick's saying, this part of the physics is easy. And in fact, with this resolution at redshift 0, half of all the mass is in lumps that were resolved here by this calculation. Just to warn you, though, if you go to higher redshifts, this is what the Press-Schechter formula predicts. You can be off here by factors of 10 easily. So do be careful. The Press-Schechter fails quite badly at high masses and at early times. You get there are error bars on these points for the correlation function, but you can't see them. There's so many particles, of course, it's extremely accurate all the way here from 40 megaparsecs down to 5 kiloparsecs. And the errors are negligible not only on the mass, but also on the galaxies. There are error bars also on this galaxy correlation function, which is a magnitude-limited sample to just below L star. You can see it's amazingly good power law. This is the mass correlation function, and this is the SDSS data. And in fact, it turns out you can understand correlation behavior not only as a function of luminosity here. These are most galaxies, are the brightest galaxies. You can see the correlations get stronger for the brightest galaxies. And you can see that they're much stronger for red galaxies than for blue galaxies, and in fact, in the simulation, the effect is stronger in the real data. These are data from 2DF, just the fits. You see the effect is qualitative, right, but we have a stronger effect than the real data here. A lot of people have been talking about measuring dark energy through looking at baryonic wiggles in galaxy surveys. They always assumed you could actually see these features in the galaxy distribution. The simulation is large enough now we can actually measure the power spectrum of the galaxy distribution rather than mass distribution and compare the two. And in fact, it is correct. So these are power spectra divided by a smooth CDM spectrum with no baryons, and so no baryon wiggles. So you see these features from high redshift down to redshift zero. The mass correlation function, the red points, the green points are galaxy correlation functions, and you can see the baryonic features. So indeed, it looks as though this proposal to use, even at high redshift here, redshift 3, where you have to use Lyman break galaxies. And so it looks as though this proposal to use these features as a measuring rod would indeed work. Okay, so now let me come back now to the feedback issues. So here are various properties of the galaxy population at redshift 0. This is just as a function of the stellar mass. This is the color. And I think this is one of the first simulations of this kind where you see the most massive objects are red. So in this simulation, the biggest objects are all old stars, have all old stars, and they no longer have any star formation. The luminosity function compared to 2DF. This is the star formation rate against surface density compared to Kennicott's law. Metallicity against stellar mass compared to Sloan data. So this is the Tully-Fisher relation. Line width against magnitude compared to Giovanelli et al. So the black hole mass, the function of the bulge mass compared to Herring and Rix's version of the Magoyan relation. So you can see we set things up so the galaxy population looks quite like the real data at redshift zero.
Are black
we are actually following it using the prescriptions of Kaufman and Hale. We actually followed the buildup of black holes simultaneously with everything else throughout the whole simulation. So we haven't done it yet, but you can go through all the other things of trying to predict quasar luminosity functions and so on, which presumably would look like their calculations since we're using basically the same model. This is, according to the model, how the various sources of feedback would evolve with time. This is the cosmic star formation rate. So in this case, it peaks, you can see, at a redshift of 4, and then declines by about a factor of more than 10. Half the stars form here, maybe too early even, redshifts 2.5. This 10 to the 10 is the halo mass. The baryonic mass of that is far below the knee of the luminosity function, so we have almost all of the light. I don't know, I haven't counted the UV. Let me finish my talk and then I have the questions. So these are the two black hole mass things. So this is a black hole accretion through the quasar mode, which is the thing which is from Kaufman and Hainault. You see that peaks at redshift 3 and declines, maybe not enough. And this is accretion in the quiescent mode, the radio galaxy mode, which actually peaks at redshift 0 because this is when the massive objects with hot halos are present. And you can see most of the black hole growth by a large factor in this model is in the quasar mode. So let me just show you now what this does to the luminosity function. This is the last part, Matthias. Let me go quickly. So here's luminosity function in the B band and the K band, compared here to the 2DF data, and here to three different things. This is Cole et al. From the 2DF, and colors, and two other estimates of the K-band luminosity function here. And the simulation luminosity function is the histogram. And this has models with reionization feedback, AGN, and supernovae. So the advantage of doing things this way is I don't need to redo the simulation to get these things, so taking away each of these sources of feedback to show you what happens. So if I take away the reionization, that's the difference. So that makes a small difference to the faintest galaxies. Okay? And that's because Nick's mass is quite small compared to masses of objects near the knee of the luminosity function. Let's take away the AGN feedback. This makes an enormous difference at the bright end. So my assumed AGN feedback which has got rid of a tail of very bright and massive objects. It's because it suppressed formation of objects in cooling flows. It's also why the bright galaxies are red, because they're not making any stars and haven't done for a long time. If I get rid of the supernova feedback, we get this. And now if you look at the K-band from here, this is basically the shape of the halo mass function. Because basically then almost everything cools off, and this then is just the mass limit of the simulation. And so you can see the three different effects take us from there to there. So the reionization is a relatively small effect, both the others are large. So reionization doesn't do much. Supernova feedback reduces star formation efficiency in the small galaxies and flattens the faint end, although it's quite hard to make it efficient enough to get a big enough effect to replace what's seen. But an additional mechanism, which here I've called radio AGN, is need to suppress star formation in the cooling flow type systems. And it's important that whatever it is should not involve star formation, because these massive objects have no young stars. So we need something like what we see in the cooling flows, where whatever the feedback is occurring is not associated with significant amounts of star formation. Here are my conclusions then. All these kinds of feedback are important at some time in the galaxy formation and its interaction with the IGM. Many aspects of the feedback are so uncertain or complex that they can be simulated reliably yet, maybe never will be. Nevertheless, the only way to make progress is to make simple physical models for what's happening and then insert them into simulations or semi-analytic treatments in order to gain better intuition of how the system as a whole behaves. It seems that star formation-related feedback, maybe also through quasar kind of AGN, optically luminous AGN, may be responsible for the faint end of luminosity function, but it seems like you need a different kind of feedback without star formation, which I've called here radio mode AGN, to cause the cutoff at the bright end of the luminosity function. Okay.
Okay, I have two questions actually. The first one concerns the feedback. So can you see any form of feedback due to the winds of a galaxy impacting on a neighbor one? Or have you tried to look for that? The second point concerns the star formation rate, which seems to me a little bit too high. Can we conclude from that there must be some, you're predicting some obscure star formation at redshift 5 or 6?
Well, this was just the first model we tried that had all the elements in, so I'm not claiming this is the answer, it almost certainly isn't. It's just the first attempt to see what comes out. And the positive thing compared to previous models is we now end up with big galaxies being old and red, as opposed to big galaxies being blue. So at least we've got this aspect of the downsizing correct, and that's because of including a formation of feedback which is not associated with star formation in big objects. So the first part of the question, then you have to look at specifically at simulations including feedback. So that issue is whether the wind cavities surrounding a galaxy are enough to encompass the neighbors. And I think the difficulty with that is you would then, how do you do this without the volume filling factor being sufficiently large that you have serious problems with Lyman-alpha forest? This may be possible, but I think it's unclear that those two things can occur at the same time, that you could have a substantial effect on your neighbors from hydrodynamic effects without simultaneously leaving signatures that you could see in the Lyman-alpha forest. I mean, I think someone who does detailed simulations of this kind should answer that. I mean, I don't know the answer, but I think that would be the issue.
So this problem with supernova feedback not being sufficient to reduce the high end of the luminosity function.
It's the faint end, yeah.
No, the high end. The fact that with only supernova feedback, you have way too many bright galaxies. I mean, that's problem has been around for a while.
Yeah, no, it's been around for a long time.
In addition to this AGN feedback, which you're proposing here as a solution, there was also this idea about code mode accretion as one of the solutions of this.
This doesn't make a difference, I don't think. Let me just go back and show you the right place here. It's close enough. Okay, so we go from here. So the effect of what I'm calling the AGN feedback is from here to here, and you can see it's mostly in this region, which is very important. So that's halo masses. Those are the central objects in dark matter halos with masses between 10 to the 13, 10 to the 14 solar masses that correspond today to groups and clusters. And what happens in the simulation if you don't put this model in is that you do indeed form a cooling flow, the gas cools, and then you end up with a massive galaxy sitting at the center, as you would get in a naive model for a galaxy cluster cooling flow. And that's what's produced this tail. And my argument is whatever has stopped that happening cannot be associated with star formation, because the objects at the center of those things don't have young stars.
So what is the time frame when this becomes important? At what redshifts this becomes an important feedback effect? This AGN.
Well, I think probably at redshift 2. At any redshifts where you see old massive galaxies which are red, then the argument would be whatever has switched off star formation in massive galaxies is now acting, so it's probably a redshift 2.
Rest mass of black holes.
Small.
So
you can see that it should be right, because this is in the model. This is the rate of increase per unit volume mass in black holes. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's the Zoltan quantity, if you like. It looks like star formation rate. So this is what's being assumed for the quasar mode, which is not having any feedback effect the way I'm doing it. This is already normalized, so it gives the right mass at the redshift zero. That was one of the constraints. So we have the right black hole density here. This is what's in the what I'm calling the radio galaxy mode. You can see it's down by a large factor.
Well, it looks like it's about a factor of 10 to 20.
Well, it's a factor. Of course, most of the time is here.
Which is the other way.
So
anyhow, then the second question is.
It's not a very large factor. I agree. I don't.
I think this is rather important because we may actually be able to observe that. And secondly, does this also solve quote unquote the entropy problem in groups? Have you injected enough heat into the system that you can puff up the gas enough to reproduce observations?
Well, I think, you know, the model is extremely schematic, so the model just assumes at the moment that you inject energy to the point that you stop cooling, and then if nothing cools, then you've lost your fuel, so it stops. So the assumption here is just that you input enough energy from your radio galaxy to compensate for the cooling, and then you shut off your supply, and that so time average, that would be the state. That's what's been assumed.
Right. So I mean, we actually know what that number should be because we observe groups at z equals zero, and that's another constraint on the simulation.
Right. I think it'll be of the same order, but I don't know exactly how it will come out.
I have a couple of questions. The first one is very simple. Is it N-body simulation or is it hydro simulation?
It's an N-body simulation.
Now, you seem to have ignored extremely important feedback process, which is due to gravitational collapse and heating of the AGN.
Why? No, I included it.
It's N-body simulation.
Yes.
How do you include the heating of AGN?
Because we have a detailed, I don't know, there's been a series of papers the last 5 years. We went through this in detail, but we have a model for how the gas collapses, and then in different situations, depending on whether it's what we call a cold inflow, so the cooling time is short, or a hot inflow when the cooling time is long, for the amount which actually cools. We've actually tested it directly against hydro simulations, and there are several papers. You can look up Rashid et al, Hel et al.
What puzzles me is that in our simulations, we don't have this AGN feedback and so on, and we can produce the normalized function fairly well. Now, we do include the heating due to IGN. So,
in
terms of energy-wise, it dominates over the SN feedback.
No, we're addressing an observational problem, not a simulation. If you look at galaxy clusters, you have to have an energy source of some kind at the center. Otherwise, the gas will cool. And we don't know what it is. Some people say it's conduction, but we're arguing that this is the radio galaxy. So I would say, if you haven't put that physics in, it doesn't cool, then you're not producing the observations.
Now, how do you implement the feedback due to the quasar radio loops?
The formula. We assume there's an amount given back by the radio galaxy, which is proportional to some power of the mass of the black hole and some power of the temperature, which is environment with an efficiency, and then we set the efficiencies so they fit for the observed systems, and then we just see what happens.
So you assume zero star formation, everything goes to the AGN energy?
For that mode, yes. That is, it's a relatively small amount of mass because you don't need much mass on an AGN to get a lot of energy back, as you know.
Now, my last comment, actually, agreement with you. Okay.
You always put it in thermally, or do you ever put it in as kinetic?
No, this is not a gas simulation, right? So we put this in the simplified model. But the two things which are critical about what I'm calling the AGN is, first, it depends on the black hole mass, so you need to have something which has a relatively massive black hole, and secondly, the feedback comes back without associated star formation, so you can switch off the cooling in the center of a galaxy cluster without having large amounts of stars. So those are the two aspects which are important. Then anything which behaves qualitatively that way will give a similar result. It doesn't have to be this particular model. I mean, so, you know, all I'm trying to do is explore qualitatively what you need to do to get the phenomenology to come out right. This detailed model, you know, maybe it's nothing to do with AGN and it's something else, but it would need these features. He knew you wanted to.
This is really exciting because there's lots of evidence now that this downsizing is a general phenomenon. And so I'd like to know how sensitive, you know, can you make a prediction of the mass downsizing effect? I don't think the mass function tells you. So can you in some way determine the mass assembly rate as a function of mass?
Yeah, I mean, for a particular model. So, you know, the whole reason for doing the simulation this way is that we don't understand any of these more detailed feedback processes. So you'd like to model them in as many different ways as possible and just get a qualitative feel for what features will produce something which looks like the observations. So the advantage of doing the simulation this way is we can put in as many different feedback models we like after the fact, and we don't have to do the simulation again. And each of these different models I showed you only took a couple of hours on a single workstation, didn't need a supercomputer. So switch off these feedback things and redo it is easy.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, this is as far as we got so far, but this is just playing with it for a month or two, and Darren, you know, has been doing lots of other things. So I think what was encouraging to me is that, you know, the massive galaxies here are red, but you can see some things aren't working, you know, these colored red things which he thinks are ellipticals, you can see all the reddest things over here are actually disk galaxies according to him, so there's still some things there which clearly need fixing in this model.
So the latest observational situation is that in the goods field we have like about 200 ellipticals now with dynamical velocity dispersions as a function of redshift. And what we see is a very clear trend like this, that the most massive ellipticals follow a fundamental plane evolution that is consistent with passive evolution with very early formation. And as you go down the mass function, it just goes completely monotonically to lower mean ages. So there's a direct correlation between the mean evolution in the mass-to-light ratio, and hence the inferred stellar age, and the stellar mass in the inverse sense of the hierarchy. So it's exactly in the same sense.
This will produce that behavior qualitatively. I have no idea if it will produce it quantitatively. And the reason it happens is because the feedback we're assuming from the radio galaxy depends positively on the temperature. This means you get more efficient feedback in objects with a large velocity dispersion. So this would still be true at high redshift. So it'll say in the high redshift ellipticals with a large velocity dispersion, the AGN is already active and has prevented further cooling and star formation. And in the low mass objects, they don't have a big enough black hole. It's not really had much environment, and gas continues to cool off and make stars. So this is qualitatively the picture that's behind this.
The extremely red objects at high redshift, and the scuba sources at even higher redshift. Kind of star-forming object at high redshift.
Well, I think that, I mean, we haven't done enough playing around with parameters to understand whether, I'm pretty sure we can move this star formation history around quite dramatically by changing parameters, but if you took this at face value, then it looks too high. I'd say, well, maybe we put all this in a hidden mode. It's certainly gas-rich.
Now, the question is, can you do this in very big objects? If you have very big ellipticals at redshift 1 and above, and if you have very big star forming...
Oh yeah, we do have big... The biggest objects are the oldest, so they're still there at redshift 1. I mean, they grow by merging, but they don't grow by further star formation.